Double X is brought to you by BowlandBranch.com, the company that makes luxury bedding affordable. Get the nicest sheets you've ever owned for about half the price of what stores and boutiques are charging. Order right now and they'll give you $50 off a set of sheets, plus free shipping. Go to BowlandBranch.com, that's BowlandBranch.com, and use the promo code Double X. And by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter the offer code Double X at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Build it beautiful. And by The Great Courses Plus, a new video learning service with more than 5,000 lectures. As a member of The Great Courses Plus, you can watch as many lectures as you want, anytime, anywhere, on any device. Sign up for a free one-month trial by visiting thegreatcoursesplus.com/doublex. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/doublex.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, November 26th, the Cate Blanchett's Mink Edition. I'm Hannah Rosen. I have a new job. I'm now co-host of the NPR podcast Invisibilia. Yay, which I'm so excited about. I'm in the New York studios. That's another cool thing with June Thomas, who's the editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah. It's so nice to look at you.
I'm looking face-to-face like in Carol when everyone looks at each other all the time. And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
We didn't look at each other long enough or smolderingly enough.
I'm working on my Cate Blanchett.
Yeah. Okay. So you've probably guessed one of our topics. I'll get to it in a minute. Our first is women in Hollywood. We are going to talk to Maureen Dowd about her cover story in this weekend's New York Times Magazine. Second, we're going to talk about the suicides in Palo Alto. It's the capital of boundless optimism. So why are so many kids killing themselves? And then finally, Carol, the new Todd Haynes movie starring Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. Okay, in this week's New York Times Magazine, Maureen Dowd talks to dozens of women in Hollywood and a few men about what she calls the pervasive sexism of the movie industry. We have Maureen here on the phone to talk to us about her story. Hi, Maureen.
Hi, Hannah.
So, the baseball caps.
Yes. Yeah.
that was like a motif. That was like a little simmering, angry motif that like ran through the story. What does the Hollywood dude in a baseball cap, like what does that represent to you?
Well, you know, Rebecca Miller, who is Arthur Miller's daughter and Daniel Day-Lewis's wife and quite an accomplished writer and director, was very astute in our interview. And she made the point that there is no archetype in Hollywood for a female director. And that's part of why they're so tangled up. They have no image in their mind. You know, for a male archetype, they used to have the director, the German director in the eye patch with the riding crop, you know, and then when Jaws happened, which revolutionized Hollywood in 75, it switched to Steven Spielberg in the baseball cap and then all of his replicants in baseball caps. And it's so funny because what women fear, and is really true, is veteran male directors will say, that guy reminds me of me. You
know? I was actually thinking.
They'll be there in the baseball cap. They'll look at a younger guy in a baseball cap and say that. And that turns out to be true because this guy, Colin Trevorrow, you know, who came from Sundance with an indie, ended up getting Jurassic World and the next Star Wars, Star Wars 9, just because he reminded Brad Bird, this older director, of him. Brad Bird literally called someone and said, this guy reminds me of me.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that is what that image evokes. So
I was hoping you would have all the women pose in the baseball caps.
I suggested that. That was, I'm glad you reminded me. That was my first suggestion for the picture on the cover, but the art department wasn't really interested in my high concept.
Another motif throughout the whole thing was that, you know, sort of the end prize is the superhero movie, is the Jurassic Park or whatever.
Right.
And this is a slightly different conversation about Hollywood, but is that part of the problem that, you know, the only big movies that get made are these movies made for, I guess, 15-year-old boys who, it turns out, aren't really, you know, buying the tickets anymore?
Right. That is part of the problem. Karen Kusama, who directed Girl Fight and Aeon Flux, and now has a really cool new Amazon series called Man in the High Castle based on a Philip K. Dick novel about if we had lost World War II and the Nazis took over the East Coast and the Japanese took over the West Coast. But she had this great line where she said, I'm so fatigued by this idea that a guy in a cape is going to come and save the world.
Mm-hmm. It's pouring.
I say this looking, actually. I have a Superman toy on my desk. So, but yes, the problem is that after Jaws, about 10 years later, you know, everything in Hollywood started revolving around foreign distribution. And so then they wanted things with no dialogue, basically, and girls in black leather cat suits. And so everything devolved to the tentpole, because once they realized they could make $1 billion in a weekend, why would they want to do anything else?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think those then would become the lowly jobs. Like, you just have some schmuck making a superhero movie, and then you spend your, you know, you have the smart people making the other movies. But I
guess it ended up causing this gender apartheid, because right. since they don't trust women to make $100 million movies, they give all of those action movies to men, and then women make movies that they consider lugubrious about their friends dying or you know, or family Thanksgivings, and they don't care about those movies. So it's gotten divided by quality, because in the old days, the old moguls were complete sexists and dictators, but they looked at the bestseller list, they'd throw a starlet into it, they would do movies that were, you know, the order, the level of difficulty for their movies was so high. They're doing War and Peace and Emma Bovary, you know, but they don't do that now. They just have, you know, Rose McGowan had a funny line where she said, you know, white men, if you're going to steal all the power and hold on to it with an iron grip, at least have something more interesting than a slate of 30 superhero movies.
It's true. It's really true.
I was thinking of some of it had to do with our idea of genius, like that somehow, you know, the men can recognize another young guy as the genius, and somehow they can't do that with women.
No, that is exactly right, because it's like the Orson Welles template in their head. And, you know, there's a YouTube of David Russell kind of yelling at Lily Tomlin that everyone, you know, has had all these likes and because so many people have watched it, and Michael Bay is supposed to be kind of a complete jerk to work with, and that's fine, because as Karen Kusama says, men make better monsters. You know, when a man is a monster on the set, the immediate assumption is that's part of his talent, that somehow the project is benefiting from that. Mm-hmm. Whereas Catherine Hardwicke, who made them $400 million with the first Twilight movie, she told me, you know, she brought Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson to her house in Venice, California, and made them make out on her bed to see if they had chemistry. You know, and she created this whole weird world. She's sort of like a teenager herself, even though she's 60, but she can be emotional, and she has been punished for it. She gets blackballed from things because, again, Hollywood is so run on fear. The women directors are afraid to say if they're pregnant. One of them was afraid to even admit she had a kid. She doesn't put his picture on Facebook. You know, the men in Hollywood are afraid to trust women with the $100 million pictures. The female directors are even afraid to give their age, you know, which is weird because they're not even on that side of the camera. But there's so much fear, like, throbbing through Hollywood.
Maureen, one of the things that was striking, you had some crazy percentages at the beginning, you know, the tiny percentage of women in all kinds of roles in these top 100 grossing movies. And it is shocking that in 2015, things should be that way. So what can we do to, or what not can we do, is nothing, but what can people do to address that? I mean, should we have quotas like for corporate boards in Scandinavia? Should we have all women shortlists for directing movies like they have for parliamentary seats in Britain? Should the makers of movies have to interview at least one female to be a director like NFL?
Yeah, like the Rooney Rule.
Right, exactly.
Right.
I mean, do we need something like that?
Well, everyone had different ideas. You know, Lena Dunham, whose father has a painting at the Whitney, said some museums have these diversity rules to make sure there are more minorities and women in the museums. And she thinks there should be quotas. You know, the director and writer of Suffragette thinks there should be quotas. Jenji Cohen, who does Orange is the New Black for Netflix, definitely thinks there should not be. She thinks that when you get hired that way, there's just so much resentment. So I think Catherine Hardwicke hopes that the men will be shamed, you know, on social media, and that the pressure will stay on so that they'll be shamed. Although it's not only men, it's the female studio executives, too. You know, one of them said to me, you know, I'm chipping away at it, and I hope it'll be better for our children and grandchildren. Now, that just blew my mind, because she thinks, well, these women's grandchildren might have it easier, and she's at the head of a studio, so I think she could do a little more than that. The head of the DGA, Paris Barkley, the head of the Directors Guild, said he hears radio silence from the studios about, oh, this is funny. There was a guy at the top of an important studio, and he said to me, you know, we had a program all ready to go to help women, but we had to cancel it. And I said, why? And he goes, well, there's all this fuss about helping women. We can't announce it now. You know, and I'm like, wait, run that past me again. So this is a different world in Hollywood. And the funny thing is, you know, they're always having fundraisers for Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer and Hillary, and yet then they go back to work and say no green lighting for women. It's bizarre.
Do you think that movies would be better if there were more women directing and being involved with these top 100 grossing movies?
Yes, because, you know, I spent a lot of time covering the problems in the Catholic Church, and I've spent a lot of time in Saudi Arabia, and Hollywood people hate it when I make this comparison. but I really think that when you cut out the hearts and minds and sensibilities of women, when you exclude that from a society, that society becomes warped. I mean, that is my honest opinion. I think that's what's happened in Hollywood. You know, David Thompson, the film historian, and Catherine Hurst, a film historian at Sarah Lawrence, agreed that Hollywood is killing itself. One woman compared it to a snake eating its own tail because the product is so anachronistic and repetitive. And so I do think it's getting very warped. I mean, I have 15 movie channels, and I can't watch anything anymore. Yeah. You know, just the product is so much worse than it was in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you completely that more women's perspectives would, you know, diversity always makes things better. I think, however, I wonder, do you think Hollywood is a business? Do you think that if more women were involved in those roles, that the movies would do better?
I think that they've got to pull out of this, you know, idea that it's either going to be dinosaurs or your best friend dying. You know, I just think that has led them down a path where no one wants to see their movies. You know, and they don't, you know, they're just going to go out on a cape if they have to. I just think they could, you know, as Lena Dunham said, if they could open it up to let women tell the stories they're good at. What they ignore, and Shonda Rhimes said this, is that women, and Meryl Streep told me this too, women can make money. Meryl Streep said, Mamma Mia made about $500 million. You know, Shonda Rhimes is minting money. She's known as the woman who saved ABC. You know, Donna Langley, who's in charge of Universal, had the best year of anyone and one of the best years in Hollywood history. Women can make money in these movies, you know, Trainwreck, Pitch Perfect 2, Bridesmaids. They can make a huge amount of money. But what happens is everybody goes, oh, yeah, that was an aberration. Like, women in Hollywood keep getting their hopes up. Like when Catherine Bigelow won for Best Director for The Hurt Locker. Oh, that's going to be the breakthrough. Nothing happened. When Bridesmaids made all that money, that was going to be the breakthrough. Nothing happened. So each time something happens that they get excited about, the men and women running studios say that's an aberration, rather than saying, how can women make money?
Maureen, do you see any significant differences in the way, in how TV is for women directors right now? A few of the women that you mentioned, you know, Jenji Cohen, Lena Dunham, Shonda Rhimes,
being Jill Soloway,
it seems like it might be a friendlier atmosphere.
It's definitely a friendlier atmosphere, but I was sort of stunned that the numbers are still so low. I mean, Jill Soloway had 100% women directors on Transparent, but the record of these web-disrupting studios like Netflix and Amazon is not very good yet, and neither is television, really. Sarah Treem, who is the showrunner and creator of The Affair, who's a really cool woman, was saying that TV is a little oasis for women, and it is, But the numbers there are still not great either. And then, you know, I talked to a director called Gina Prince Blythewood, who did Love and Basketball and The Secret Life of Bees. And she's kind of like, I'm in love with film. I don't want to have to go to TV. I want the studios to just let us in the room.
Maureen, thank you so much. I think it was powerful to put all of these quotes and people and ideas in the same space. So the
yeah, you know, some
great.
Of the bigger women like Catherine Bigelow and Elizabeth Banks and Sofia Coppola wouldn't do it. I guess they didn't want to be grouped with a bunch of women. But I thought the fact that a lot of the women weren't as famous was very moving.
They were pretty famous.
Yeah, yeah, a few of them. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Maureen, for coming on to
talk.
Okay,
thanks a lot, Hannah.
Bye.
Bye.
Now we're going to move on to our second topic, Palo Alto. But first, let's hear from our sponsor, Bull & Branch.
There's one important thing you can do to help ensure having a good day, and that is to have a good night's sleep the night before. One company has set out to make this possible. It's Bull & Branch. They've reinvented sheets and bedding with the sole purpose of making your nights more comfortable than ever. Their bedding is so soft, it will be a new standard of comfort you'll measure everything else by. You can only get these products at one place, bowlandbranch.com, where you know you're paying for quality sheets and not department store overhead. You're getting amazingly luxurious sheets for a couple of $100. Go online to bowl, that's B-O-L-L, and branch.com, and they'll let you try them risk-free for 30 nights. And it gets even better. Go to bowlandbranch.com today for 20% off your entire order. Sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers, everything, plus free shipping. And all their products come beautifully packaged in their signature boxes. Go to bowlandbranch.com today for 20% off your entire order and use promo code XX. Bowlandbranch.com, promo code XX.
Okay, on to our next topic, the suicides in Silicon Valley. When we think of the Valley, we think of innovation, gadgets, boundless optimism. But the Valley is also the site of an unusually high number of suicides in its two major high schools. In this month's Atlantic, I wrote the cover story about suicides and what they have to do with pressure on upper-class kids to achieve. So I'm turning this over to you guys because I'm not going to ask myself questions. So you guys ask me something about that story.
Well, Hannah, what made this different? Okay, we've heard about all the pressures that are on kids all over the country. I mean, obviously, suicide cluster is a pretty unusual thing. But what else about Palo Alto is unusual?
First, I'll tell you what's unusual, and then I'll tell you what's completely like everybody else. So what's unusual about Palo Alto is that these schools are extremely high achieving. It's right. These are the children of Silicon Valley kids. And so their standards for what they consider normal or successful are just way higher than everybody else's. I think it's just an accident of this historical moment. Silicon Valley is like the center of the universe right now. That's where all great things come from. The shrinks in Silicon Valley were telling me that people who come to them come because they think 10 million net by age 40. If they haven't achieved that, they are failures. So that's kind of what's in the air, right? Like, that's what kids grow up with. And so like, really, really normal stuff just doesn't rate. So I think that's where the pressure comes from. Also, I went to Stanford. Palo Alto is like a tiny little town. It was not meant to be the center of the universe. I was thinking, for example, what's different between these kids and kids in New York? New York is diffuse. Like, you walk out of your high-pressure New York high school, you got lots of alternative universes versus swimming in front of you on every block. Palo Alto is like tiny and sleepy and the birds are chirping and it was not meant to be this way. We thought of the kids from the Palo Alto high schools as like the townies when I was at Stanford. So the idea that it's now become this super high achieving place, it's like you feel like you can't get out. It's like that's all there is in that space. On the other hand, I think it's kind of like a lot of other meritocratic, high-achieving parenting places. It's not that different. The reason I wanted to do this story is because the suicides force you to pay attention. Like, we all do this all the time. We're all ambivalent about it, we meaning parents, but we don't really think about it until there's a double cluster of suicides, and then you kind of get slapped in the head with it, and you have to think about it.
At one point in your story, you speak with a young woman who attempted suicide when she was in high school, I believe, and now several years have passed. She went to Harvard. She, you know, kind of has the life, I guess, or the credentials that were the ones that she was supposed to be pushing for. And you almost get the impression, in fact, maybe she even explicitly says it, that the reason she did it was to kind of put a pause on things and she couldn't think of any other way of doing it. I mean, we know that we're always as journalists, cautioned not to suggest that this is what caused a suicide. But do you feel comfortable saying that the high pressure expectations are the trigger for the suicide crisis?
No, I mean, that's one thing I write in the story. It's like the closer you get to an individual suicide, the less you understand, like, well, why this kid and not another kid who was under a lot of pressure? That's really hard to understand. Besides, like, there's a mental illness associated with suicide just by the very nature of the thing. That's definitional. But I do feel comfortable saying that there, it's very hard to find a pause in that culture. And so what a lot of the teachers told me is that should you find yourself in that black hole, which this young woman, Taylor, was in, or even should you find yourself where, like, your parents are getting divorced or your favorite grandparent died or some situation where you're just, like, reached a standstill mentally, that's very hard to find a space to feel or, like, have a space to grieve or have a space to deal with your mental illness. There just isn't that much space. You just get the sense that you're falling ever further behind. So in that sense, a culture of achievement and a culture of, I would say, like, wellness and healing are not that compatible.
Hannah, one of the sort of underlying socioeconomic themes of it, you spoke to a researcher whose name I'm forgetting.
But Sunia Luthar, yeah.
So she basically said that there's sort of like a U-curve when it comes to basically problems with adolescents, right? So people who grow up in very poor communities have a lot of, you know, depression issues and behavior issues, and so do people who grow up in communities like this one, which rang true with sort of what I know. I went to a high school that is, you know, Palo Alto-esque, but less so, I would say. But it, you know, the richer the kids were, it seemed like the more problems I had. And another interesting part of that, too, was that these kids who are in the wealthier families where, you know, like you said, a lot of helicopter parenting seems like you're getting close to your kids. It seems like the kids didn't actually feel close to their parents. Their parents were involved in their life, but there wasn't a sense of closeness.
That was just cold water in my face. Sunia Luthar has been doing this research for a long time. She's just one of the rare people who collects a lot of data from rich schools just because they don't want to give out data. And so the U-curve is surprising. Everybody wants to resist that conclusion. It's like, really, I'm supposed to feel bad for these rich kids? And I think you're not ultimately supposed to feel bad for this rich kids, but you are supposed to have empathy for their adolescence. It's like a temporary problem where they're just squeezed under this pressure at a time when they can't really handle it. The thing about not feeling close to parents was cold water in my face because I wrote the story of the overprotected kid and I was like, okay, we're ruining our kids, but they really like us, you know? They feel really close to us. Well, it turns out not exactly. They just kind of feel a lot of pressure from us in a lot of cases. And I guess the most depressing thing to me was the internalizing of it. I quoted this woman, Madeline Levine, who's been writing about this for years, which is to say, like, it's so out in the culture. It comes to you not from only from parents, but from teachers and from colleges and from everywhere, such that it just is. It's just the air. And so kids sometimes are much harder driver than their parents. So it's like you can't really blame the parents. It's like totally internal, where kids just have this internal sense combined with some misery about it, but still this internal sense that terrible catastrophes are going to happen if they don't achieve. So a lot of the mail I've gotten, there's a lot of angry mail from Palo Alto people saying, like, you stupid outsiders coming and, you know, pissing on our culture. But there's also a lot of mail I've gotten from siblings. My sister has a 4.4 GPA, and she's driving herself crazy, and she has to hire a tutor. Can you email my parents? Can you help me out? Like, wow. That was the kind of unexpected mail that I got from people.
Yeah, there's a point in your piece where you talk about how the kids have Stockholm syndrome. Like, there was this big battle. This guy whose daughter had killed herself wanted to make a concrete change, and so he pushed for the end of called zero period. So you could opt into a 7:30 a.m. class, which honestly, like, I was a, like, very, you know, straight A high school student. 7:30 a.m. You couldn't have paid me to be at school. But these kids wanted the extra, I guess they wanted, you know, another AP credit on their, you know, to average into their GPA. And so this man led a charge to do away with it. And the kids were the ones protesting, not their, like, overprotective parents. And what was the argument that they were making?
Well, can I just say something? I went to the board meeting where the kids showed up with this giant packet where they had done this survey showing that, you know, whatever it is, 84% of kids actually really want zero period. I actually went home that night and watched scenes, like YouTube clips from Dazed and Confused. I was like, wait a minute. Kids don't actually like school. Like, I had to remind myself that, like, in movies and stuff, kids, like, get angry when they have to do more school. So what was your question again? It was whether...
But that's a more interesting point, actually. So that was another interesting thing, was your question, like, where did the counterculture go? And I... Yeah. I spent a while last night just trying to figure that out. And I don't know, like, what happened?
Yeah,
to
I'll
it?
Explain that. I mean, that came to me after I wrote the piece when I was thinking, so why is that, you know, when I, surely parents have always put pressure on their kids to achieve, and this is just something that's always existed. What's different? Maybe the thing that's different is that there isn't a countervailing force. Like in the 60s, there's obviously a counterculture, but there's a fight against materialism, there's grunge, there's punk. Like in every decade, there's something that kids can identify with, which isn't this prevailing achievement culture. We don't have one right now. And where did it go? Like, why don't we have one?
Right. And even like, I'm trying to think, I mean, I think kids are really into sort of being famous on the internet and that kind of thing. But even that is a sort of achievement culture of its own. It's very pre-professional. It's very polished. It's high pressure.
You have to put work in.
Yeah.
Well, since you were talking about the zero period and the early start, I was really struck in your piece by your noting that a lot of these kids are barely get any sleep because they're always working or whatever, for whatever reason, they're just not sleeping. And I was also, you know, thinking, wow, you know, postpartum depression. I know moms are also sleep deprived. I mean, I don't know. Did your research reveal anything about sleep?
Yeah, there's a great Stanford sleep researcher. I mean, in the grasping for causes, there's lots of them. And like what the people close to the situation say is like, no, we can't draw the direct link to suicide, but you can talk about misery and anxiety, and sleep is one of the causes of misery and anxiety, and then misery and anxiety is a cause of suicide. So you can draw some links, but it's true. Like there, people are doing a lot of, like the Arianna Huffington seeps down into the younger ages and trying to get these kids to sleep more. And it's like at every step you push against the system. We'll get them to sleep more. So teachers, how about you coordinate your assignments so that they have these assignments every other day and not every day? And colleges, how about you stop demanding this, that, and the other thing? So it's like, I think everyone's kind of starting to get the message and work in tandem. There's been so many books about this, like Frank Rich's book.
Frank Bruni.
Oh, sorry. Frank Bruni's book.
Frank Rich is in the ether.
He's in the ether today because we were talking about him. Yeah.
Hannah, I know you don't mention this at all, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. Another group of young people where there is a bump in suicides is around LGBTQ youth. In your research, I mean, was there any commonalities? Was there any overlap? Is there any connection?
That surprises me. Doesn't that surprise you? I haven't made sense. Just because you think this would be the moment when there wouldn't be a bump in LGBTQ youth.
I mean, I think I'm not so sure that's true. I think we're doing big city thinking there. Like, all our friends are cool. But and I think, unfortunately, there's so much internalized stuff. But
you know, one thought I had about that, which is true of the working class white people as well, is that suicides are associated with dashed expectations. So suicides often happen, say, on Mondays after a weekend, as opposed to murders, which are more common on weekends. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the way that you can track these things. And I wonder if you're not in a big city and there's kind of an expectation of acceptance and of love and of ease, and then that doesn't happen, that causes a certain degree of deep misery. Mm-hmm. So let's hear from our next sponsor.
Our next sponsor is Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter offer code XX, that's DOUBLEX, at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. So I have a personal website, noreenmalone.com, that I think it's probably been 2 years since I've updated it. It's one of those things that's always on my to-do list. It always falls to the bottom of my to-do list right after getting this one photograph framed that just I'm never going to get framed. And if I were a Squarespace user, it would be done already. It would be so much easier. It would not be this onerous chore that I just kept avoiding. I really have to look into this. Now, switching to Squarespace is going on to my to-do list. They have professionally designed sites. The tools are intuitive. They're easy to use. And you get a free domain name if you sign up for a year. So to start your free trial today, go to squarespace.com and be sure to use the offer code XX, DOUBLEX, to get 10% off your first purchase.
All right, let's talk about Carol. Now we get to talk about a feminist triumph in Hollywood. After a long and hard fight, the movie Carol, about a lesbian relationship in the 50s, opened last week. The movie is based on a 1952 novel by Patricia Highsmith called The Price of Salt. It's considered a rare lesbian book with a happy ending, and it's praised, among other things, for capturing, as Brian Lauder wrote in Slate, the miracle of queer connection. I thought that was a great phrase. Joining us in this conversation is Margaret Talbot, a New Yorker writer who wrote about Patricia Highsmith in this week's New Yorker. Hi, Margaret.
Hi.
All right, before we get too far, we are going to listen to a clip from Carol. And I also want you to know, we're not going to reveal details about the ending, but we are going to discuss the meaning of the ending. So just be warned, if that's going to turn you off, then skip this segment.
And your meals.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoy.
I'm starved. Bon appetit. What do you do on Sundays?
Nothing in particular. What do you do?
Oh, nothing lately. I mean, if you'd like to come visit me sometime, you're welcome to. At least there's some pretty country around where I live. Would you like to come visit me this Sunday?
Yes.
What a strange girl you are.
Why?
Flung out of space.
I saw it like 5 minutes ago. Literally, I just walked out of the Angelica Theater. So it's very fresh in my mind. But June, will you give us the basic plot outline?
I will. So it's Christmas time in New York City in the early 50s, and Therese Bellavette, who's played by Rooney Mara, is working the toy counter at a New York City department store. And a beautiful, glamorous, gorgeous, fur-clad woman comes in, an older woman, and she buys a toy for her daughter for Christmas, and she leaves her gloves at the counter. And so Therese returns them to her, and thus begins a friendship, I guess, when the woman, who's played by Cate Blanchett, her name is Carol Erd, when she gets the gloves, she calls the store, she speaks to the young woman and invites her to lunch. And then from there, they kind of get to know each other. Carol is having some trouble with her husband, her estranged husband, who is suing her for custody of their daughter. And when, after a sort of a troubling, dispiriting time with the daughter going off with him, Carol suggests they go on a road trip, and they go off on a Lolita-like road trip around the Midwest.
Wait, Lolita-like road trip?
I think if you read Terry Castle's piece that was in Slate about 10 years ago about The Price of Salt.
Great piece, by the way.
Yeah. She points out that there's a lot in common with that road trip. They're running away from something. They're running towards something. There's this element of something that's forbidden in what they're doing and yet also innocent and loving. And they're being surveilled in a sort of similar way. So stylistically, I think she meant with Nabokov's novel and Claire Morgan or Patricia Highsmith's novel, there's a similar kind of vibe to it. And then eventually, there's some conflict in the relationship, but by the end of the movie and the book, Therese sort of blossoms.
Is that a metaphor, Jane?
She didn't blossom in a mud puddle. She blossomed. Isn't that what Carol says when she sees her in the bar? You've blossomed.
You've blossomed. That is exactly what she said. I have to say, some of the dialogue in the movie is quite hard to deliver out of your actual mouth.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I admire them for doing that. Like, I wrote down a couple, like, you're trembling at the beginning of the sex scene. And then there's one she says twice, which is flung out of space. You know, that's actually hard to say to another person and sound like a person talking to a person.
I think Cate Blanchett really pulls that off, though,
yeah.
I have to say. I mean,
yeah.
That's I think it's either a recurrent line or just a line that really jumps out at you in the book.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is very stilted. It's not very stilted. It's somewhat stilted language, I would say. You know, kind of true to the era. And Todd Haynes, I think, really loves being true to the era and sort of trying to project as much emotion that is more kind of vivid and raw and recognizable and modern in a way, you know, through the kind of container of that stilted language as he can, or that 1950s kind of mannered, you know, Douglas Sirk style movie language. I don't know. For me, it works. Does it for you?
I have to say, Margaret, I totally love that line. And I think in Brian's piece that you mentioned earlier, Hannah, he points out that it is just so perfect for the feeling that you get where in a world where you are a distinct minority and you can't really identify other people, when you spot someone and you make a connection with them, it does feel like they've been flung out of space. It just feels like such an amazing miracle. It's a beautiful, notion.
Well, the whole tension of the movie comes from the constraints of how they move, how you speak at dinner, mm-hmm. how you dress, you know, which occasionally burst open, like when Kate Blanchett has to go to her in-laws, you know, 10 times and pretend she's not a lesbian so she can get her daughter back. She says, you know, how many times do I have to eat tomato and aspic? It's like that feeling, like how many times do I have to sort of restrain myself in this seat? I'm wondering about the book, how much the looks, is that a movie technique or is that something that occurs? Are they always looking at each other? The movie is so corporal, you know, it's like eyes, it focuses on hands. Mm-hmm. Even before the sex, the movie is very much looking closely at body.
Yes, I would say actually that the gaze at one another is a big motif in the book and very, you know, romantic, and it's kind of key to the conclusion of the book, and it's key to their first, you know, seeing each other. They're literally kind of locking eyes over the sea of, you know, shoppers in Bloomingdale's toy department. So, yeah, I mean, it's powerful, I would say, the book.
Doreen, you're having silent thoughts that you're not expressing.
No,
just
I'm
like Carol,
I'm,
Kate Blanchett looking at a window.
She's looking at all of us.
If only you had
radio.
Red lipstick. Then.
I know. I want to like live in that movie. It's so gorgeous looking. But I think one of the things I loved about it was the pacing of it, which I think in the plot is somewhat aided by the fact that this wasn't a straight couple, right? And then it was the 1950s. And so even once they'd had this incredible spark, they were still, like, even when they were alone on a road trip for days and days and days, nothing happened. And to me, that the, like, sort of slow progression, like, usually there were about 8 different points where I thought something was going to happen and it didn't. And in a more sort of typical movie and in a more modern movie, what we think of as a modern movie, they would have, you know, mm-hmm. fell into bed a long time before that. And I thought that just made it more elegant almost. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But even when they're discovered, I was thinking, how would it have been different if it had been two men? Even when they're discovered, there's a kind of non-comprehension around the lesbian relationship. It's not like disgust, horror, shock. It's just like, what is this?
Well, you have a feeling that the people, as much as they didn't understand it, had some kind of template for it. Like, so Therese's friends are very bohemian, arty types, but they're, you know, young dudes mostly. And so their sort of template for that, their way of explaining it is it's a crush. It's a schoolgirl crush. And especially, I think, because Carol is older than Therese. And so that the way they push it away is to think, oh, it's some weird thing. And it's not something that they're really comfortable with, but it's explainable. It's not, they don't really see it in sexual terms.
Yeah. Right. And actually, Todd Haynes has this interesting way of talking about it. He talks about sort of the indecipherability of certain kinds of, you know, relationships between women in that period because, you know, the conventional mind not quite being able to go there. And so allowing people sometimes to have a kind of hiding in plain sight kind of, you know, relationship, you know, where they could maybe live together and it might actually cause less scandal, you know, than heterosexual unmarried couple living together in the early 50s or probably certainly than two men. So it's kind of interesting. It's caught in this like visible invisibility kind of period of time.
Yeah. How much was class a factor in all this? Like when Noreen, you were saying that you thought the movie was gorgeous, there are times when the movie becomes less gorgeous. Like Rooney Mara, there are times when she looks plain and there are times when mm-hmm. she looks radiant, you know? Mm-hmm. There are times in the early scenes in the shop, and I love all that shop girl anthropology. I just love that. It's not that beautiful. Like Todd Haynes takes time to show us the shop girls eating lunch in that drab cafeteria. And I wonder if that's all a setup such that when Kate Blanchett walks in, she's from a different world. Like you can smell her perfume in the movie, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking.
And her fur, I mean, she's wearing this sumptuous mink coat too. That's, you know, really significant. And she's always in red too, in these beautiful scarlet clothes. You know, that's her kind of color in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, for me, Carol is something very different. I mean, the book, I would say, was, you know, as you point out in your piece, Margaret, it was very much there was a strong autobiographical element from Highsmith's own life. She too had worked in a department store over the Christmas holiday. She'd also glimpsed a beautiful, older, elegant woman. She'd also, in her case, memorized the address and written to her. In real life, Mrs. Sen didn't write back, although, as Margaret mentions, Highsmith did go off and to New Jersey, to deepest New Jersey, and spy on her. But, you know, it's Carol that says that Therese was flung from outer space. But I think there's a feeling, too, of Therese being surrounded by not necessarily mediocrity, but harshness and dullness and ugliness in a way. And then beauty appears. And it is so different and so striking that definitely there is a class element, I think. But there's also just this, you know, here's hope. Here's the thing that she didn't know exactly what she was looking for, but she knew she wasn't satisfied with what her current options were. And so I think there's a real, like, Carol is a life vest in some way.
Hannah mentioned at the beginning that this was, at the time, like, the only lesbian novel that had a happy ending, which I think in your piece, Margaret, you sort of said contributed to its high sales. And I wonder, how long did that remain the case? Like, you know, for decades afterwards? Or did this, as the 50s kind of came to an end and were replaced by sort of, you know, a more countercultural experience in American life, were there happy endings in lesbian novels?
You know, I think, and, you know, Hannah or June, you may know more about this than I do, but I think that in the 60s there started to be more, I mean, obviously, like, you know, Ruby Fruit Jungle and even sort of comic, you know, kind of rom-com kind of toned novels, and then also very earnest ones. I remember reading this one, Patience and Sarah, that was about, like, two frontier women, you know, pioneer women who, you know, lived and loved together in the 19th century.
But
that is,
that
I recall,
one.
A happy ending. They were never like torn from their log cabin or anything. So, you know, I think probably by the 60s that was changing, but, like, you know, this was in contrast, the happy ending was in contrast to books like The Well of Loneliness earlier, and then all these lesbian pulp novels in the 50s that were very popular, but literally almost like in a kind of like a Hays Code kind of thing, had to have an unhappy ending. Like, they could have sorority girls, you know, having a relationship, but then one of them had to be institutionalized at the end, and the other had to realize that she actually, you know, wanted to be with a man. So, you know, it was very different from those.
And I think what's different, too, about The Price of Salt was it was very literary, that maybe that was why it got to get away with having a happy ending, because certainly those writers of the pulp novels, they would have loved to have a happy ending, but it wasn't possible. But I think, you know, Highsmith, who did not publish it under her own name till, what, 1990, Margaret?
Yeah, right.
You know, she was writing a different sort of book. And so even though, you know, I would say in the 70s, 80s, there were a lot of lesbian novels with happy endings, it took a while before there were literary novels because there wasn't much of a market for them. And that actually is something that, Margaret, I loved your piece and I have absolutely no beef with it, but it's kind of a frustration to me that lesbian work goes kind of, it's kept within the community. It doesn't sell, so a lot of it doesn't get published. You know, that's what happens. Mm-hmm. If books don't sell, more don't get published. And lesbians know about them. Lesbians write about them, but our world, you know, the places that I used to write about lesbian novels, they may have heard them, but they never read them. And then, you know, a certain number of years later, it sort of enters the mainstream, and then suddenly it's, you know, Frank Rich is writing about it. And
Frank Rich has long been a friend to lesbians, I would say.
Oh, that's exactly what Alison Bechdel said about Fun Home. She's like, what? I don't know. I just wrote this for my... It's this idea that they get rediscovered over
and
over
again. Exactly. I mean, Alison Bechdel's a perfect case because she was doing Dykes to Watch Out for 25 years, many of them in complete poverty and obscurity. And then, you know, Dwight Garner gave a good review of, I guess, Fun Home. And then it's like a process of discovery, but it's not like the work has changed. It's just like finally people are discovering something. And there's a kind of an element of frustration in it to me, with no tea or shade implied to anyone present. But what's your reaction to that, Margaret? Because it's not really, it's not animus against you, certainly not personally, but, like, be the represent your people for me.
Be the representative of the heterosexual
mainstream
of a lesbian novel. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I could see that being totally frustrating. I mean, I have to say, I had not read this book before, and I had read other Patricia Highsmith novels, and I have to say that, you know, it's actually now my favorite of her work that I've read. So, you know, I mean, I guess I feel happy that it's, you know, known now. And, you know, I think the movie is going to be a lasting, you know, thing. And so, you know, I guess I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the answer to that is, how to sort of bring work. I mean, like, well, let's say what's a novel that you think, a good novel, not to put you on the spot, but what's a good lesbian novel that has not gotten its due, has not gotten the attention that it deserves, that's come out in the last, you know, I don't know, 10 or 15 years?
Well, actually, even before the last 10 or 15 years, someone that you talk about in your piece, Mary Jane Meeker, who had an affair with Highsmith and who wrote a biography, or what would you call it? I guess a biography of Highsmith.
Yeah, a memoir. Which I really liked, actually.
Yeah,
it's very
great
kind
book.
Of lively
and you mentioned another one of her novels that she wrote. You know, she was a writer of pulp novels. But under her own name, she wrote this fantastic novel that came out, I believe, 1973, called Shockproof Sydney Skate, which is about a young boy whose mom is a lesbian, and she doesn't know that he's decoded the sort of secret language that she uses with her lesbian friends. So he knows exactly what's going on. And I think there's actually a kind of a dialogue with The Price of Salt, because his mom is in love with a young woman who he's also in love with, and he's also trying to court. And so it's a really great novel and very fun and funny. So
I think it's time for a lesbian book club.
Yes.
Clearly.
Well, and not to plug my own magazine too much, but along with the Frank Rich piece, we had an annotation. We asked a number of women, lesbians, to tell us what are the other classics that those of us in the straight world don't know about, but that are like truly great and have been ignored for too long. Those are
perfect.
Up on newyorkmagazine.com.
And it's a really awesome list.
And June Thomas participated.
All right. Well, on that happy
self-promotional
pro-June note.
Our work is done.
Yeah, our work is done. Thank you, Margaret, for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure. Happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you.
So let's move on to our recommendations. But before that, let's hear from our final sponsor, Great Courses.
So Great Courses is sponsoring us today. We're very grateful for that. Now, thanks to the Great Courses Plus, there is a fantastic library of Great Courses lectures that are completely available to people who join. You can watch the Fundamentals of Photography and hundreds of other courses free for 1 month. All of the fantastic courses on the Great Courses Plus are available to you for free for 1 month. You can get started with a great offer. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/DOUBLEX. There's a huge range of online courses that you can take one after the other until your thirst for knowledge is satisfied.
Now it's time for the recommendations. June, why don't you go first?
So first of all, I would say Jessica Jones on Netflix is fantastic. Everybody should watch it. But my real recommendation this week is a fantastic book called The Story of My Teeth by Valeria Luiselli, who, despite her Italian name, is Mexican, although she lives in New York City now. And it's storytelling. It's all about the importance of knowing who created a work of art. It's a tall tale. It's beautifully designed. It's the kind of book that you have to, I think, see in person and experience in person. But it's really, you know, I like to have mentions of teeth in books. I'll just note now that Patricia Highsmith was had a thing for dental gas, as did Virginia Woolf.
Like for fun?
Yeah, it was one of her things. That does not come up in this. So I like to hear about dentistry, and this book has teeth on almost every page.
Where do you get dental gas from? Do you have to have a friend who's a dentist?
I'm not sure they even really have it anymore. I only had it when I was a kid. I mean, I haven't had it since.
I have really fond memories of the dental gas from my youth.
You and Patricia Highsmith. Anyway, The Story of My Teeth was written in collaboration with workers at the Jumex Juice Factory in Mexico, and it's fantastic.
Sounds very June-ish and excellent. I'm going to recommend actually not a book, but a book review, which is of a book that sounds truly terrible called Curvology, which is an anthropology of women's curves, which was reviewed by Caitlin Flanagan in the Washington Post. A review so hilarious that I read it out loud back and forth with my daughter in the kitchen this weekend. It is just truly, truly funny. So if you want a few minutes of delight, go and read Caitlin Flanagan's review. Noreen.
I'm going to recommend a movie that's streaming on Netflix from long before women were cut out of Hollywood and it was all superhero movies. It's actually written, I believe, by Nora Ephron's parents. It's a movie called Desk Set, starring Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, made in 1957. And it sort of predicts the rise of computers and the end of American skilled labor. Katharine Hepburn plays a research librarian at a television network, and Spencer Tracy is the MIT scientist who comes in with his supercomputer and does away with her department, and spoiler alert, sparks fly, both literal and metaphorical. And it's really good. It's great in all the ways that Katharine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy movies always are.
Excellent. And Noreen, I mean, I was going to watch Aziz Ansari anyway, but man, did I enjoy that. Really, really enjoyed that. I just was so sad when it was over. I tried to parse it out like night to night, and then by the end I was like, I'm done.
Night.
Yeah, just watch them all. All right. Thank you to our producer, Ann Hepperman, to Andy Bowers, the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Our intern is Shiva Bayat, and the XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. For more information about the show, go to our show page, slate.com/XX, or our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest. Email us at XXGabFest@slate.com or subscribe on iTunes so other people can find out about the show. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you again in 2 weeks.
Wanna thank you. Yeah.
Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all-purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now.
Save big money.